Great. So Eric is finished, but not finished, because he's going to stick around for the next panel, which is related. We're staying with the same theme of new ways in which publishers are ambitiously expanding their role in creating, controlling, and licensing intellectual property, but we're going to turn it to a larger panel so we can hear more about what other people are up to. We have independent IP attorney Dev Chatillon, whose clients include Callaway and Zola Books, here to moderate, and she's going to introduce the panel.
Great. Thank you very much. Good morning to everybody. We have a great panel today. I'll give you a little bit of my background and then a little bit of the panel's, and then we'll kind of dive right into it. I'm currently practicing on my own. Before that, I've worked at places as diverse as ABC News, Miramax Films, Scholastic. I think half the audience has probably worked at Scholastic at one time or another. And I take that as a great compliment to everyone who works there and the company. And I think one of the things you'll see that we all have in common on this panel is we've either worked in diverse media kinds of platforms, or we've worked with companies that have crossed those platforms. So in the middle, wearing the check shirt, is Corinne Hellman. She's the Vice President of Digital Publishing and Business Development for HarperCollins Children. Her job is to find new ways of making money and telling stories using HarperCollins' beloved children's brands. Prior to HarperCollins, Corinne worked at Scholastic, as did I, and she worked on, among other things, 39 Clues, which you've heard a bit about, and I think we'll hear a bit more about during the panel. Before that, Corinne also worked at Prime Media and Rodale, so again, crossing a lot of media barriers. Swana McNair, who's also there, is a founder of a new model consultancy and intellectual property management firm called Creative Conduit, as well as a next-generation transmedia firm, Electric Yarn, which is reimagining how stories are told and also how they're owned, and she'll talk a little bit about what that means. Prior to these really interesting ventures, she worked at Hyperion, at literary agency Fletcher & Co., and in the motion picture industry, including with Paramount and New Line. Eric Wang, I think you know well already. He also, before he landed at Penguin, worked at Disney, Disney Publishing in L.A. He was managing editor of Penguin Australia. He also worked for an Aussie toy company, and then to the U.K. as head of licensing at Paragon. So again, has crossed a lot of those. John is Yeged, last but not least, is a retired lawyer, I think, or yes, lapsed lawyer, as we like to say, having started his career in entertainment and technology lawyer for some really great prestigious law firms. He then worked at Disney, Hyperion Books for Children, but also the Consumer Group, which is where we met and worked together when I was at Miramax. And he held a number of different positions there, ending up as a U.S. publisher of the Disney Book Group, including product development for Disney's global book licensing. He's currently president and publisher of Macmillan Children's Publishing Group, and in between also served at one point as a chief operating officer of a social media marketing company. So again, has crossed a lot of the media platform barriers. We're going to start off with John doing a brief presentation and then have a discussion. We're going to split up the presentations a little bit with some talk. So we'll keep talking.
Oh, it's great when it works. Good morning, everyone. So I'm here to talk a little bit about Play and Learn with Wallace. It's a relatively new series of apps from Pretty Books, which is our early learning imprint, focusing on early learning skills for infants through early elementary school. So just quick look at what Pretty does. This is a representative sample of what Pretty does, a basic early learning colors, numbers, ABCs. That would be a spread inside. And what's interesting is that over the years, we've started developing this content. We own it. We own the photographs, in this case, some of the illustrations. Generally speaking, with some exceptions, we own all the material that goes into our Pretty Books. So, and our Pretty Books generally have a lot of tactiles, a lot of interactive elements. So given our mission to create great books with nice, bold designs for kids, to help them learn, apps were a natural progression. So what we went ahead and did was we created Play and Learn with Wallace. And we wanted to keep that same bright, bold look and feel of the books, be consistent with our history, but also be able to use all that rich content that we've developed over the years to create a great early learning experience for kids. So I'm just going to walk you through just a bit of the app, and you can see how we've used that content that we've owned over the years.
Hello.
So first,
which game would you like to play with Wallace today?
So first off, you have Wallace, and Wallace is our dog, and Wallace happens to be Roger Pretty's dog, so the kids like to know that. So just a quick home screen. This is when you download the app, it's a free download. It enables you to get access to all the various apps you have available, you purchase within the app. So let's take a quick look at First Spelling.
First Spelling.
Doesn't usually
touch the first letter sound of van.
So you could see we have the van that we've used in multiple books. It appears here. Van is V. Yes. So.
Van. Great job.
Yeah, Wallace is sort of the guide and friend and companion as you work.
Drag the letters to spell fox.
Now these apps come. There's six play spaces on each app, and there's multiple variations between words and images that could appear. So it's a very diverse experience. So there may be 30 possible versions of this mix and match letter, which is really in depth for one app, and you multiply that by six for each play space. I'm glad this one came up because this is a good one.
Ox. Ox. Fox. You did it.
So you get a sense of how the app works.
Touch the word that starts with.
That's not what I wanted to do. As kids progress through the app, they'll eventually get rewards charts and medals. And I'll show you a little bit more of that later. The biggest reason I'm not going to work through a whole app now is if I get one wrong, I'll be really embarrassed in front of everyone. So in addition, I'm sorry, I hit the wrong button, so it just has to load up real quick again. So in addition to having all the various apps, we have this super shuffle mode, which we think is pretty interesting. Now, quick caveat, this is development build, so there's certain apps that are not commercially available, which, because it's random, may appear when I hit super shuffle. The VO will not match the images, but you'll get a sense of what we're doing. So what super shuffle does is it enables you to play any of these spaces from any of the purchased apps. So if you have a words app the first puzzle
balls?
App, all those play spaces come into play. So the more you buy, the richer the experience can get with super shuffle mode. It's really endless. So this is count five balls.
One, three, four. Five.
Got them all.
Great job.
And we move on. So. And this is one
touch
that's not going to work.
Touch the correct number ring.
Yeah, it's not number. But you get a sense. That's from one of the new puzzle builds. And it will be brown, and you don't need to see it because I guarantee up there it is. All right. So let me show you what else we have just real quickly before we move on. So in addition to just using the images
touch
and the
two that makes a pair.
And elements of story that we've built into this using sort of Wallace as a host, we've also built in a parent's guide. And the parent's guide just lets you track a little bit of what apps your kids are playing and sort of how they're doing. Real basic tracking, more directional than anything else. We'll give you a sense of what apps we have, what they're coming. And this is also a blended learning experience. So the kids, it might be an app about spelling or letters, but you're also going to learn problem solving and pattern recognition and dexterity and creativity, and you get a sense from that. And we do have our apps are in both English and English. So... And finally, we have the player's profile, which is really good. Up to four player profiles could be created. We can change the themes. You could be a space explorer. You could be a farmer. You could be a princess. And as you progress through the app, you'll get medals. And let me show you those real quick just so you could see what happens there. So after you complete six successfully play spaces, you'll get to a rewards chart. The stars will spin and you'll get to pick a sticker. Once you get 10 of these, you'll get a reward certificate. They're themed to your experience, so that's what a farmer one looks like. That's mine. I did well on the spelling. So that's a little bit of a sense of how we took the content that we owned and expanded it to this sort of branded product extension experience.
Sitting down? Is this working? There we go. I think the question for the whole panel, we can start with John, is this is own content. Why is it you started with that? Was it more appropriate for what you wanted to do, where you had the own content and you wanted to make use out of it?
Well, it's easier. when you own it, you could do what you want with it. It also helped that the pretty books had a long history of early childhood development, and it was a natural extension. But it would have been a lot harder had we not owned the content.
Right. And Eric, you mentioned in your presentation, do you own all of those properties? Does Penguin?
We don't. We own some of them. But I think an interesting thing to keep in mind, though, is that ownership is one thing, but we do have a classic picture book brand that we own. However, in the contract with the estate or the original author, that author always has to have approval. And this author is not really an open person, per se. And so the thing is, I think ownership is one thing, yes, but in a lot of the old sort of publishing deals, if you have an approvals clause, it's as good as not owning it because you can't do anything without their approval. And it's not consultation, but it's approval. So
right, so we should probably clarify a little bit what we mean. Again, what I was doing was distinguishing between the traditional licensing model in which the publisher had a license to do a limited run of things for a certain number of years, as opposed to the publisher having story ideas to begin with in the most classic, and hiring people in to
then
flesh those out.
That's definitely preferred.
Yes. And then there's a lot of stuff in between, and I gather what you were describing is one of the in-between ones where the ownership is with Penguin, but the author has a back-end, I assume, and approvals.
Yeah.
Are any of the ones you described ones that are fully owned or that were developed fully in-house?
Yes, there's several that are fully owned. Hattie B is one that we own, Planet Bots as well. I can't remember what I talked about, but yes.
And how of and if you can tell us this, of the percentage of this is really to any of you, of the properties that you're doing in a sort of, for lack of a better word, transmedia way, how much of that is owned and how much of it is licensed in the more traditional?
None of them on our list is the traditional licensing model. We may not own it all. Most of them are co-owned.
Mm-hmm.
But not in a traditionally licensing way, actually.
And John?
The majority of our stuff is still the traditional license model. Pretty is the one imprint that's pretty much an exception. I can envision various ways over time where we could do a co-ownership model or own ourselves and have interactive or transmedia approach to it. So I think we're open to doing it in all ways.
And have you had success in doing transmedia or doing, say, at least one step in the direction of transmedia with a more traditional licensing model?
We have people that are interested. I'm not sure we found the right property yet.
Right. And, Corinne, I know you've done traditional licensing in apps and other things because we worked on a few. How has that gone?
It's easier when you own everything and you can make your own choices, but my most successful apps are the traditional derivative of existing property. So,
where there's already an existing audience and existing brand recognition.
Exactly.
Yeah. Swan, anything you want to say on this part before we...
Yeah, no, I think I'm just talking about, because with Electric Yarn, we're doing both, where we're working with media companies who already own their content, and then also partnering for ownership stakes with the author or content creator from the beginning. So I think an openness from publishers, as you're wanting to partner with publishers too, is really important to that process, but... the language and the deals, of course, are different pretty much every time.
Right, which can be a barrier as well. So why don't you...
Oh, sure, yes. Hi, so very excited to be here today talking to such an open group in children's publishing content. So first I thought I'd start off just telling a little bit about as Deb said, my background is in film and television, and then as a traditional literary agent, as I call it. And then I recently, a couple years ago, started a firm called Creative Conduit, where I'm working with individual IP instead of just working with representing an author for the entire lifespan of their work. I recently started a new company with partners called Electric Yarn, and I'll talk about that today because we're focusing really on children's IP and development. So Electric Yarn is a next generation transmedia firm. And so really our vision, we're reimagining how stories are told, shared, developed. Of course, a little bit as Eric talked about, storytelling is always at the center of this and everything we do in talking about partners. So whether it's with the media, device, education, global, It's important to talk about before I start going into how we ask for ownership from our authors, because as my traditional literary agent hat, I know you're like, wait, that's not fair. So it's important. It's collaboration. Collaboration is key to everything we do with our partnership. So I drew in a team that know how to do things I don't know how to do. So one of them, my partner Lorna, has a background as a technology specialist for huge retailers and brands and product software implementation. My other partner, Elizabeth, came from Apple, where she's was a veteran producer in marketing and e-commerce. And each one of these people that has a very creative streak, and they were in charge of telling the story at their own divisions, at their big brand. So we bring them in at the beginning. So what we do, we develop intellectual property into digital products and multi-platform franchises. And again, that's whether it's working with a publisher or media company or a brand that already has built-in content that they own fully, or with our content creators how they have built franchises that the content has not been launched yet. So again, building franchises, the 360 brand experience, our collective experience can help develop out these franchises that are so important, especially when talking about the challenges with discoverability these days and where do you find places. And so partnering, again, is so important, whether it's the right print publisher, the right brand, the right consumer product. I'm just going to talk a little bit about our first product. So we have a slate of children's franchise projects that we're launching, and I'll talk a bit more about the deals that we've made. So this first one is called Josie Robbins Science Fiend. It's a multi-platform edutainment franchise. How this came to me is my old Hollywood roots. A lot of people come to me with stories. So the creator, Drew Filas, is a screenwriter and a director living in L.A., and he was an elementary school teacher. So often it comes to you as a side project. He wrote this children's book because his daughter, he couldn't find anything about teaching him the love of science and math and technology, STEM. And so, of course, when I say, he said, can you help me find a print publisher? And I said, well, let me do this. So what we've done with Josie Robin is we've actually created a partnership from the beginning, a corporation, an LLC. So, and the things that we've decided to do is we're going to create an immersive experience, a digital experience first. So that'll be pop-up lessons, touch interactions, doing digital ecosystems. And this is all the things that we're doing. I think it's another thing to note is, so with Josie Robin, we've created a partnership where we own this IP, Electric Yarn, and, of course, Drew, the creator, from the beginning. And this is something, and this is because we want to make deals down the line for our consumer products, that there's an ease to those deals. So we have approached brands first. So Pottery Barn Kids is someone we've been talking to that actually about investing in our digital ecosystem, and they're very interested. We've actually gone to our development partner is Twin Engine Labs, who's based out of Shreveport, Louisiana, and they're the developers behind the wonderful, fantastic flying books of Mr. Morris, Less More app. And what we're doing is we're building value from the start. So then when we go to our publishing partner, when we go to our consumer product partner, our toy partner, we've got so much on the table, and we're creating these avenues from the beginning. So that's just one of a multitude of children's products that we go to. Some people ask, why did we choose children's? A lot of it is our personal love for children and wanting to teach a love of reading, and also the adoption, the habits of the proliferation of tablets with parents and teachers and purchasing, that it makes a bit more business sense too. So that's what we're doing. Thanks.
So I think what we'd like to talk about now is sort of how are people putting together these products with owned IP? How are they being developed, and how does it differ from traditional print process? Eric, you talked a little bit about that in your talk, and it sounded as though you were getting story ideas from a generation from a bunch of different places. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
A lot of what we've been doing is about partnerships. So especially when we're going into TV in particular, realizing that we're not TV people. And whilst we might have a really great sort of a vision for what it might look like on TV, it's really important just to, I guess, partner with other companies. And I think that openness is something that's not traditionally found in publishing per se, where you kind of go to a third party and even let them in on the game or to part owning it as well. So I think for us it's about partnerships. And we also, we've started an in-house kind of IP sort of story generation team that's also kind of generated some of the ideas and helped kind of expand some of the ideas that you saw today as well. So it is about looking at it from a different way rather than just the book you want to publish, but the step up, the world that the book fits into.
So if the story team comes up with an idea, what's the next step?
The next step is that they have to land it with one of the publishers. So, it's not that we want to be Disney or anything. If we want to create a brand, we
publish
first.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, no. But I think the thing is we're a film company wants to create a brand, they'll make a film. But we're a publisher, so we'll publish. And all these ideas we would publish whether or not there was TV, you know, film and consumer products. That's a bonus. But they have to land it with a publisher, and someone has to love it and kind of drive it forward.
And then after you found a publisher, then what's the decision-making process about, what format will it take you? Some of things are going digital first, some are going print first.
Part of it is at acquisition, but it's also I'll get involved if it's a project that's more than just the book, and sort of my team will kind of have a lot of conversations about it. Different ideas tend to just lend themselves quite easily to. So far, there hasn't been one where we're like, ooh, we don't know. And generally, if you don't know, we just don't do it.
The story tells you what it wants to
yeah,
be.
Yeah, exactly. It's simple. It's like, ooh, it's going to be that.
John, is similar for you?
Well, it's a little different. I think Eric has a team set up that we don't create or acquire that way. But what we have done with what would be traditional licensing deals is we've gone and looked at picture book creators and others and said, hey, why don't we throw all the rights into a bucket? We'll come up with some sort of co-deal together and figure out how we can build that out. And we have a few of those. And I think the reason that the authors like working with us because they trust us. They know that we happen to be very good at helping them get the most out of a property. And we have more resources that they than they have to build it out. So I think more and more that's becoming another option that we can do. And again, it's property specific. When the right ones come up, we'll look at that kind of model.
And do you do that at the beginning when something's first submitted or for existing properties that already exist in one form or another or both? And why? And yeah. How and why?
Generally, I would want to do it from the beginning. There could be something that we didn't do it originally, and then we say, wow, it's an older contract, or things have changed, now we see different possibilities. And then we'll go back and say, hey, this is something that's really exciting. Let's talk about how we can do more together.
So if a new property comes in the door, and this is really to any of you, is it important to envision it across multiple platforms at that point as more than a traditional print or even ebook?
I think for me it depends on the idea, because I think not every TV story should be a book or vice versa. It just depends on the idea. Certain ones just lend themselves better to toys, TV, everything, but not everything. And I think that the danger is to try to cram everything into this big consumer products kind of transmedia strategy where only certain stories should be that, I think.
I agree with that too. I mean, even from my perspective, it's not like you're taking any story that comes along and saying we're going to cram it into this hole. It really has to be organic from the beginning to work on these multiple platforms. And so part of that is knowing what works or not, whether you're the author, the content creator, or working with people who would know how to develop it out like that. So, and your publisher knowing that as well is terrific. So.
Can any of you give examples of things that have come in that have sort of leapt to the front as this must be a multimedia property or?
Can or will.
Sorry?
Everything I'm working on.
Everything that you've already done, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose one of the things is that preschool and children's properties lend themselves more to kind of extended storytelling than say, adult brands. That's one thing, and I think it tends to be brands that are more, kind of disagreeing with myself before I even say it, it tends to be brands that are more, I think, like character-led, that tend to work for us rather than concept. I know that's really vague.
And John, it looked like what you were showing us is more concept-led than it was character-led.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we brought Wallace in to help. I think kids need a character. I do believe that kids gravitate towards character. And that's why we added Wallace to help. We could have done everything we did without Wallace, and I think Wallace makes it a much richer experience.
And much more fun. If a printed book isn't part of the equation, what advantage do publishers have in this space? Why should an author or a creator or storyteller use a publisher as opposed to a movie company or a digital consultant agency or somebody else?
That I don't think they should. I mean,
explain.
Everything we do has a book at its core. That's what we are. And if that's not the case, then anyone off the street could do the same thing. We have no competitive advantage. We don't bring anything to the table. And we certainly don't have the pockets that a movie or a TV partner would have. So
I don't think we do now. But I think hopefully we're all moving towards a place where we can offer that. But I think you're right in that. If someone has an idea where a book is at its core, yes. But if what they really want is to make a film, we'll go talk to a film company. Or
yeah, know. And I think I always think there should be a printed book as part of the equation. And I think a lot of misconceptions are sometimes about either or what's more important. And it's really just a matter of sequencing. So just because the book app might come out first, or the enhanced book, or the enriched, it doesn't mean one is more important than the other. And I think the value of the printed book is core, definitely.
I agree, and I think that if someone just has no desire whatsoever to do a book, then a publisher's not the right place to be. But if someone has a world or a series of characters that they want to develop, I think a publisher is a good choice, because we're very good at long-form storytelling. And you know, more specifically, we're very good at working with creators to come up with a long-form storytelling. This is stuff that, you know, a book lasts for, you know, hours, sometimes weeks, and series of books even longer in someone's, you know, mindset. Movies are in and out in a couple hours usually. We're very good at building that, and I think if people look at publishers as their partner to do that, we could bring a lot to the equation.
I don't necessarily think that you need to have a physical book. And I think, you know, in say 5-8 years time, the definition of a book, I hope if we've been successful, will be to include a lot of things that right now we just see as that's an app.
And I was going to actually, that was going to be my next question, was if it was going to be a digital iteration, be it, you know, an app or an ebook, would you all say, oh, no, you shouldn't go to a publisher?
No, I think you should. Yeah. And a lot of the brands that I showed, they are going to be apps first. But I think where we create an app, it's generally a reading experience, even though there may not be page turns and sort of gutters and, you know, the traditional layout, but it's a reading experience or an education, you know, loosely speaking, an educational experience, which is where it makes sense for us to do it rather than, say, a really great game, because we don't think that way.
Right. And presumably have more access to educational consultants than many of the game companies
yes.
do,
yeah,
speaking
yeah.
from experience. Which brings us to, I think, the last sort of bit, which is why. Why is this happening now? What does it mean? And Corinne, let me turn to you with your experience at both HarperCollins and Scholastic. Of what are the kind of changing business models that are either fueling this or benefiting from?
Well, I think it's all stemming from the fact that if you think about traditional publishing, we'll buy 400 books a year, and we can't afford to buy the multimedia rights for all 400, knowing that only 20 of them might actually take off. So we make the success with the book, and then the rest of the world benefits from it through, you know, TV, movies, gaming, whatever. So this is changing the paradigm. This is us saying, let's participate in all those other ancillary products by creating things ourselves. It gives us freedom that we don't have when we are tethered to an author who has every right to say, I don't want you to do this.
Right. I've decided to go to Electronic Arts or Warner Brothers or somebody else to do it. Can you talk a little bit about the 39 Clues and sort of how that came about?
Because
sure. That's one of the early examples, I think.
It is definitely the earliest example. Scholastic had a little IP group. And they had created many IP books prior to it, but this one was, the conceit was, can we come up with a story that's actually going to have a world that's rich enough to support an experience that lives far outside the book? And after 2 years of development, it finally came out the other side, and it really was an integrated conceit, because you needed to have read the books and bought the cards and played the game in order to qualify for the prize, which was really kind of the carrot that was holding everything together. And that made every aspect of the property interdependent. It wasn't like, yes, you can read the book and have a great time. You can. But if you really want to live in this world, you've got to do it all.
And how much of this is driven by the change in technology itself? I mean, for one thing, that struck me when I was working with one of the app developers, Callaway Digital Arts, is the touchscreen sort of changed the paradigm for kids, and certainly for early kids, because pre-literate children could for the first time really access digital content in an interactive way. How much do each of you think that's part of what's going on?
Very much. I mean, if you, the proliferation, every consumer media habits has changed incredibly. Now we're dealing with digital native generations, with kids. And I think that the care that goes into places like Scholastic or places like Penguin to really making sure those fears that some parents, I think, have of like, oh, they're looking at tablets. It's like, no, this is a way, this is happening. And the tablet adoption and just the rise and increase of sales. And so that influences, I think, how you can do it on any medium now. You know, medium means, you know, a multi-platform. So it's really, I think it very drives it for us.
Eric, John?
Well, I think, I mean, definitely. And I think, you know, when the iPad and even, like, you know, touch phones first came out, I think, you know, almost everything in the book section of the App Store were being created by people who weren't in publishing. And I think for me personally, that was something where I was like, hang on, you know, why aren't we as an industry the ones leading this? And it was always people on the periphery or people who had no idea, had no training, but, you know, they were able to break the rules because they didn't have to unlearn what we had learned.
And how different is this from what the movie studios have been doing for many years, when they would own a, they would get a franchise and they would own that, and then they would have peripherals coming out?
I suppose it's not that different, and I think we're late to the game, because I do think as an industry we've always been a bit more precious, and I think, you know, to our detriment. Mm-hmm. But no, it's not an old model, I think, what we're doing now. We're just kind of, I think, you know, we were the first storytelling industry, but we let all the sister industries kind of, you know, basically run us over. Like, we'll create a brand, build a big brand through books, and not participate in anything else after that. And so I think we're late to the game, but, you know, I hope, you know, we charge ahead now.
And at some level, we do all the work in the sense that we've published the 400 books. We've taken the risk in finding only the 20 that succeed. And then the movie companies swipe in and take the 20, you know, the 20 that are working and have a jolly happy life.
And I would think also that the fact that production barriers are lowering, certainly it's much easier and cheaper to produce an app than it is a major animated motion picture.
Yeah, we can reach the consumer direct now, so which is
exactly
a huge thing.
Sort of.
I mean, even on the app costs, I wouldn't have done the Pretty app a year and a half ago. You know, the cost would have said, hey, it's probably not worth it right now. Let's see what happens. But the costs have come down so far on the development side that it made it worth the risk.
And to that, just quickly, the point why we're working in Louisiana so much is they have aggressively approached us, Louisiana's economic development, because their digital media incentives are so high and so incredible that to make an effective product that you can get out and make cost, so it's not cost prohibitive of, well, to your consumer is important.
Are we ready for questions, or?
3 minutes.
Okay, we have 3 minutes for questions. Way in the back.
I run a medium-sized company in Canada, and I don't know that I need this.
I think they want you to have it, if you'd be so kind.
We can't hear it. For years and years, we have been licensing various products for film, for television, for everything. And last year, Apple approached us, and they took one of our books, and they did a couple of enhanced projects and that kind of thing. And what I'm trying to figure out, many of you come from very large companies, and I'm wondering, for a smaller firm, does it make sense to bring this, the creation of apps and all of that in-house, or are we smarter to continue? If you're able, I mean, the other thing I think many of us have been able to do is hold on to, in terms of subsidiary rights, a decent portion of what we get on that. If you're not necessarily working with some of the big agents, we keep a big percentage of what we license.
I'm
trying to figure out what makes sense financially, if you're not a large house, to keep licensing some of this, or to bring the development of apps and all of that technology in-house.
I actually think it's easier in a smaller company. Doing innovation in large companies is really challenging. I sometimes think I would love to be in a company with 10 people so I could just do whatever the hell I wanted to do. So I would think that it's true for any size company. That said, I've done 30-some-odd apps, and I've not done a single one of them myself. So it's not like I have the expertise to do it. I just go out and seek the best partner to make it happen.
Yeah, I think you really have to look at your bottom line and your numbers, and we've had that discussion ourselves, and as you scale up, and it sounds like you're already doing well keeping a lot of the subsidiary right money, so sometimes partnering. And I know Canada has some great developers and incentives. And
We have time for one more question. Yes. Great question.
Yeah, I think it's that we as publishers are just offering more than just being their publisher. So I think, you know, the savvy authors and the savvy agents, I think, you know, whereas before they might have to go to five different people or five different companies to kind of, you know, envisage to sort of execute their vision of a story or an IP, they can just now come to a publisher. And obviously it's up to us to prove that we can do it properly. But it's really just about the amount of services we offer authors and agents now has changed.
And one of the things we've talked about, we kind of ran out of time, but I think we have 30 seconds, is that if a big company, a Penguin or HarperCollins or Macmillan, is the one trying to go out and sell movie rights, the barriers that movie companies put up, for example, like, oh my God, there was an app, you sold interactive rights, I can't do a movie, it tends to be something that the bigger companies can negotiate better with things like the movie studios, places like the movie studios, than individual authors, illustrators, or agents can. Not always, but... Yeah. It's certainly one thing certainly I've seen, and I think people on the panel have seen.
Okay, I'm here with the hook.
Okay. We are dutifully hooked.
Thank you very much. That really was a great panel.